I see that it's going to be a challenging job to change a Los Angeles, to train a Los Angeles audience on the meaning of a shiur, to come with a chumash, to come prepared. Some of you've got it on your phone. You've got your chumash on your phone. And to get into the learning, because the things we're doing, particularly tonight, are deep. And as I explained to you, just the value of the words of being able to see, a word, is really very, very important. And to use an iPhone, Eric, that's a bidyeved. For the bidyeved, it's good. You didn't bring a sefer. You haven't had a sefer. You've got an iPhone. That's wonderful. But it's quite important to know that, for example, have you seen people using an iPhone as a siddur?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It doesn't work.
Don't like it.
It actually doesn't work. What do I mean by the fact that it doesn't work? If the purpose of your siddur is just to remind you of the words, because you don't know it by heart, then an iPhone kind of works. But a siddur is a lot more than that. We talked about it once before, that maybe in the last year, that every Hebrew letter has an enormous amount of energy. And when the words come together, they have a whole lot of energy. When you see it on a computer screen or an iPhone, there's no transference of energy. It's just information. It's just digital information. It has no power. So say, for example, even the difference between a Sefer Torah and a Chumash, a printed work and a handwritten work, is like the difference between an original and a duplicate of a work of art. So what's the difference in value? What does the Mona Lisa cost? The real one. What does a duplicate cost? That difference is the difference between a Sefer Torah and a Chumash in its value, and the value of the words. Because in an original work of art, the artist has actually invested energy into that work of art, which stays there and which you can access when you look at it. And the same as when you read the words of a Sefer Torah. Not only is it the meaning of the words, but you actually access the energy of the Sofer who wrote it. That's why we're so meticulous about who writes a Sefer Torah. If you couldn't get any energy from it, who cares who wrote it, as long as the words are there? If it's just information, who cares who wrote it? But we do care. The Sofer, the writer of a Sefer Torah, has to be a tzaddik, has to be somebody very spiritual, very energetically powerful, so that he can infuse that energy into the Sefer Torah, and you can extract that when you read it. So when you're reading a printed Sefer, you're reading a Chumash, it's nowhere near that level, but it's something at least. Somebody laid out the print, somebody set it, somebody handled it, somebody printed it, and it was made also, it was made for a specific use, which gives Kedusha. Kedusha occurs when something is dedicated for specific use. If something has multi-use, it has no Kedusha. So a Sefer Torah, for example, you're not allowed to use for anything else other than to read from it. You're not allowed to use it for anything else. And a Sefer Kodesh, even a Chumash or a Gemara, you can't use for something else. You can't even use it to support another book, or you can't put another book on top of it. So Kedusha is a function of dedication. What does a man say under the chuppah? Harei at mekudeshet. What does that mean? Exclusive. That's what it means. Exclusive. From that exclusivity comes Kedusha. A Sefer Torah's use is exclusive. A Chumash, exclusive. A Siddur, exclusive. An iPhone? The opposite of exclusive. You can use it for pornography and you can use it for a Siddur. Same thing, same object. That's a sign that has nothing in it. It's just a tool. So to use a tool to daven from, why do that? When you've got an opportunity, so it's a little bit more effort to hold the Siddur instead of an iPhone. But use Siddurim, use Chumashim, use Harim. It's what's kept our nation together for all these years. And let's not lose that tradition. To turn learning into technology, that would be a terrible tragedy. So that's why I appeal to you to make the effort to bring a Chumash, to open a Chumash, to dirty the pages, to make marks on it if you want to, use it. So it becomes yours, and you build a relationship with the pages of a Chumash. You can't build a relationship with the software in the iPhone that shows you the Chumash. There's no relationship. You turn the iPhone off, and now it's on CNN, and gone. The relationship's gone. The Chumash never goes. You go home, and that Chumash you were learning from is now on your bookshelf. And do you think that the Chumash picks up energy when it's in this room? Of course it does. Everything, our clothes pick up the energy. Everything, you're in a room with other people, you're picking up energy. You take it home and you put it on your bookshelf. But the software on the iPhone doesn't pick up energy and it doesn't give out energy. There's no energy. Technology drains energy. Technology is wonderful. It's incredible. It's the most exciting thing of our generation. But it drains human energy. If two people are talking to each other and there's an iPhone on between them, it doesn't have to be an iPhone, it can be any phone, that's on between them, what does that do to the energy of the conversation? It drains it completely. Completely drains. You want to have a conversation with somebody? Turn your phone off. If the conversation's not important enough, don't have it. Text them instead. But if you're having a conversation with the person, you have it without. And it doesn't matter if you're a millennial or if you're an old person. The principle is the same, and nothing changes. It's just behaviors that change, but the principle is the same. That technology drains energy. So it's a great bidyevet. You're stuck on an airplane, you need a siddur, you've got an iPhone, that's amazing. You want to go through the parasha, you haven't got a chumash, you can use the iPhone, that's an incredible aid. But it's just an aid, it's just a tool. For learning, we still use phone. And we're going to use forum for a very, very long time. Thank God for Shabbos. Because if it weren't for Shabbos, we would have done away with forum already. Who would buy forum anymore? At least on Shabbos, you need a sefer. You can't use it. You can't use technology, so you have to have a chumash in your house. You want to learn some Gemara at home, you have to have a set of Gemara. It's coming to a point, you'll walk into somebody's home, you won't know it's a Jewish home, other than a mezuzah on the door. And today the goyim are putting mezuzahs on the doors too. But that doesn't make it a Jewish home. What makes a Jewish home is this phone. That brings an energy into the home. It brings, and you know, people say of general books as well, you walk into somebody's library and you know a whole lot about them. What they like, what they read, what's on what shelf, how they classify, what goes next to what. You can tell a fortune about a person from looking at their library. Now you walk into a house, there isn't a library. Well, that also tells a fortune. So it tells a fortune about a person. The soul of a house is the people and the books, and maybe the art. That's the soul of the house. Without that, it's not a home, it's a house. It's just a building. So really important, and I'm emphasizing it not just because of the importance of getting used to what learning Torah is, and it's not about information. It's about something much more complex and much more energetic and much deeper than information. But also because it fits into what we're learning about, the energies that we're learning about, and the creation of the world and everything that we're learning really aligns with that a great deal. Now, one of the difficulties with learning Chumash is that with all other works of literature, we tend to graduate from work of literature to work of literature. So when we're children, we learn, we read children's books. And then we read books for teenagers, and then we read books for young adults, and then we read adults' books. Our literature grows with us. The problem with Chumash is we learn the same Chumash when we're 6 as we do when we're 80. The Chumash doesn't change. We're learning the same. There's no child's Chumash. I remember when I was in elementary school, it wasn't a religious school, I used to have a child's abridged version of Chumash. And my father was so disgusted. Do you remember that? After Geft in the Jewish day schools, there used to be those thin little, the whole of Bereishis was about 50 little pages of big children's print.
Left out the word Batah.
The bridge version, I remember my father being very, very upset with that. Yeah, Chumash is Chumash. It doesn't matter if you're a 6-year-old child or you're an old person. It's the same Chumash. The Chumash was written in all its divine genius to be able to appeal to every culture and to every age and to every generation. And that's what it is. That's its brilliance. The problem, the challenge with that is that particularly these parts, the parts of Bereishit, which we do learn as children, we develop a childlike understanding of them, and that remains our understanding. That doesn't evolve and develop. We learn about Adam and Chava and the snake when we're 6, and that's the picture we go through our life with. And it doesn't evolve and it doesn't develop. So in literature, the material evolves because you read different things, but in Torah, you read the same thing. And we don't revisit it with an open mind to say, forget what I learned as a child. What does it mean to me today? And that's how you're going to learn Chumash. What does it mean to me today? Not what was I taught in Cheder. When I learn this piece of Chumash, what does this really mean to me today? So that's what we're going to look, because we're going to be revisiting this the whole story of the snake. And we need to try and see it with adult eyes and understand it in greater depth, perhaps, than we did as children. The last time you'll remember, we spoke about the difference between image and identity and how they're both necessary. A human being has identity, but a human being also needs an image, certainly after eating from the tree, certainly after Adam's choice. But we already saw signs of it coming into the creation from the time that Hashem even gives a name to the tree of knowledge. Once the Eitz Hadaat is even just mentioned and named and defined, and once Chava is defined as a woman, so there's already the definition of male and female forces in the world, even before she's created, we see that the idea of image and identity is already introduced. And both are needed, and both are important, and both have divine purpose. And we talked about the vulnerability, that we talked about what shame is, that shame is, and the word shame is a complicated word in English, and it just has lots of baggage attached to it. But shame in terms of humiliation, not somebody else shaming me, but humiliation is when my image is stripped away from me involuntarily. That's when I am humiliated. And that's true shame. Whether it happens just so, or whether I do it myself unintentionally, I expose myself, I expose my ignorance, or I make some kind of a mistake. And by exposing ourselves in that way, we sometimes find that we feel humiliated, we feel ashamed, we feel let down to ourselves. And busha, that busha can also happen if somebody else does it. Somebody else strips my image. I have a certain image and I'm thought of in a certain way, and the image is stripped away, and that creates humiliation, that creates shame. Vulnerability is when one willingly drops the image. And we said it's not binary, it's not either on or off, there's a spectrum. And you dial up or dial down the image depending on who you're with. And intimacy is the complete removal of image. If you can be with somebody with whom you don't need image, or you need very little image, there's no time. You're never with somebody that you don't need any image. That's not a wise thing to a wide situation to put oneself in with anybody, but with somebody with whom one is an intimate, the level of image goes down to a very, very low level, and it's much more about sharing of identity than it is sharing of image. Yes.
So is vulnerability a positive aspect?
Yes, vulnerability is a very positive aspect if it's used correctly. By the way, one of the points I made, Ephraim, I think you might not have been here, is there was a request not to have questions during tape.
Okay.
But please, afterwards, I'll make a point of leaving time so that
you
can just make a mental note of, unless there's something that's really disturbing somebody and they're not understanding, then of course just interrupt and we'll deal with it. And we ended off last time saying, and so all this is kind of set, Adam and Chava are without image, pretty much, which is why Vayehu Shnehem Arumim, and we translated that as Arumim, and they were both Arumim, meaning naked, literally. Arumim means naked, and we said it's basically without image. Clothing is the metaphor for image. Clothing is the really fundamental idea of image. Clothing is the way we present ourselves, and we talk quite a lot about how we use image to amplify identity. Image is not to hide identity. Image is to amplify identity. Image is to give access to identity. People are attracted by image with the knowledge that behind the image there's a whole identity that they don't even see, that isn't even exposed. That's what makes something mysterious. That's what makes something attractive. So you need that combination. Please sit down. You need that combination of image and identity to be able to create the attractiveness of mystery. They didn't have that. They didn't have a need for image. Since they didn't have a need for image, they were arumim, and since they had no need for image, lo yitboshashu, they were not capable of shame. Because shame is when you lose your image, involuntarily. That's when you have shame. They couldn't lose an image, they didn't have an image. Everything they had was identity. And that's what that nakedness means, that arum means, that they were that they had no identity. And then we said, and the beginning of the next chapter begins with the strange use of the same word in a completely different context. V'hanachash haya arum mikol chayat ha-sadeh asher asa Hashem Elokim, and the snake was the most arum, which we've just translated as naked. But in this case, it means sly. Of all the animals of the field that Hashem had made. And what does that mean? A snake is sly. Why is the use of the same word, arum and arum? Is that just coincidental? So we're going to go much deeper into that tonight. So the Nachash sees them intimate. He sees, as Chazal tell us, the Rashi says, quoting a Medrash, Ma inyan ze lekan. I'm going to be reading some sources out tonight so that you see them in their actual wording. Rashi says, Ma inyan ze lekan. Why is the story of the snake put in the middle? We're just told Adam and Chava were naked. And further on, at the end of chapter 3, we're told Hashem made them clothes of leather. Surely that should come now. Adam and Eve were naked, and Hashem made them clothes of leather. That should be the next thing. Why the story of the snake? So the Medrash answers, El alam, lamedecha me'eze etza kafatz ha-nachash aleihem. But to give us a bit of the background of how the Nachash came into all this, the snake came in, and what was that all about? Ra'aotam arumim v'asukim betashmish. He saw them naked and being intimate together. La'en kol, in the open, because they had no image, there was nothing to hide. What was there to hide if you don't have image? You only have identity. V'nit'avela, and he desired her. So he is disturbed, the snake, and we're going to get into who the snake is. The snake is disturbed by their intimacy, because that's something he can't have. So the animal kingdom, we saw how Adam studied all the animals and saw how they couple and how they pair, and realized that's not what he wanted, that's not what he needed. He was able to imagine something far beyond that, and he was able to imagine real intimacy. The Nachash now on the other side, just as Adam studies the animals and comes out of it with a picture of sanctified intimacy, the animal, the Nachash, studies Adam and Chava and realizes they've got something he'll never have. And he's determined to destroy what they've got. That's the nature of the Nachash. Ever come across such people? If I can't have what you've got, one thing I'll do is make sure that you don't have it either. And sometimes that's conscious and sometimes that's subconscious. So that's what the Nachash does here. Now starting off with an understanding of this word arum, which means naked in the case of Adam and Chava, and in the next sentence the same word is used, and there it means sly, wise in a sly way, and that's how Unkelus translates it. He says he translates the first one as naked and the second one as sly, but the Targum Yonatan translates it differently, and in the case of Adam and Chava, he says, Bahavu tarvehun chakimin. He translates arum there the same as in the second sentence. Because arum also means smart. It means street smart. It means smart in a sly way. That's what arum also means, in addition to being naked. And one can question why the same word. But the Targum Yonatan uses that same translation even with respect to Adam and Chava. So Adam and Chava are wise, not naked. And yet, and this is how he translates it, so what does it say? And they were not ashamed. Velo amtinu biyakrehon. And they didn't understand fully the value. They didn't understand what busha was. They didn't understand what shame was. They didn't understand any of that, as wise as they were, because they had no experience of image. And then on the V'chivya Havei Chakim, and the snake was wise. So the Targum Yonatan says in both cases it's talking about wisdom. Adam's with a different type of wisdom, Adam's wisdom and the snake's wisdom, but in both cases talking about wisdom. So now I want to take you into a more Kabbalistic understanding of the nakedness of Adam and Chava, because we're going to learn it on two or maybe even three levels, which one can do with the Torah all the time. You can learn it simultaneously on different levels. So I'm going to take you into the deepest level first, and then we'll come back to the easier levels. And here we're going to learn a piece of Netziv. Now, Netziv is a fascinating and very important person, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Valozhin. Valozhin was the kind of the founder of the whole modern yeshiva system. and it was the first major yeshiva. He introduced a lot of interesting innovations. So, for example, he did not allow people in Valozhin to donate to the yeshiva. In those days, the yeshiva boys didn't pay. They were on scholarship. He would not allow the people in the town to pay. Not only that, but he paid the townsfolk very well to provide food and lodging for the children, for the boys. And his reasoning was, they must never see the yeshiva as a burden. They've got to see the yeshiva as an economic engine to give it the right kind of status in society. He never wanted the yeshiva to be the lowly place, the down place. He wanted the whole town to realize that without the yeshiva, they can't even survive. That it brings the economy into the little town of Valozhin. And he built the yeshiva on a hill. And I saw it a couple of years ago when I was there. Anybody who's been there would have seen it. It's on one of the higher parts of the town. There's a palace there. The government offices are there. And the yeshiva's there. He wants people to look up to it, literally. He wanted people to look up to the yeshiva, not look down at it. The property was much cheaper down in the valley. But he didn't. That's not where he wanted Torah. He wanted Torah to be looked up to. That's how he positioned it. And he himself his father-in-law was Reb Yitzchak of Valozhin. Reb Yitzchak of Valozhin was the son of Reb Chaim of Valozhin. And Reb Chaim of Valozhin was the Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. So this was the school of the Vilna Gaon. And he married a second time. His first wife died young. And he married a second time. He married his niece, who was the sister of the Torah Tamima, which is also a well-known and very advanced, very modern thinking work. And they had a son, whose name was Reb Meir Berlin, who became Reb Meir Bar Ilan, who was a big leader in the Mizrahi movement and was the initiator of the Bar Ilan University. So this is a man who's had enormous influence through many, many decades, centuries on us. So he writes a piece on the Chumash. He writes a perush on the Chumash. And I'm going to read and translate this to you so that we can learn and understand it quite clearly. So this is on the piece of they were Arum, Vayu Shnehem Arumim, they were both Arumim, Ha'adam v'ishto, Adam and his wife. And we've said Arum has two meanings. It means naked and it means wise. V'lo yitzboshashu, and they were not ashamed. Does the word yitzboshashu mean anything else other than shame? Does it ring a bell to anybody?
Moshe.
Yes, where do we have Moshe? With Moshe. He was Shesh Moshe. Moshe was delaying. He was tarrying. He was procrastinating on the mountain. So that same word, nothing to do with Shem, just happens to be the same word. But when that happens and the Torah chooses to use a word that has multiple meanings, all the meanings are interwoven into the actual piece of writing. As we said, I think I've explained to you that Hebrew is as complex as English, but in the opposite way. English is complex because there are many words for every idea, each with a slightly different meaning. And Hebrew is complex because there are many ideas to every word. So Hebrew is a very small vocabulary language. English is a very big vocabulary language. And I don't know about other languages, but I don't think there are that many languages that use thesauruses. So we use a thesaurus. You've got an idea and you want to know exactly which word to use, and you get a selection of words and then you check them in a dictionary to see which is exactly the word that conveys what you're intending to write or to say. In Hebrew you don't do that because they're not synonyms. On the contrary, every word means so many different things. So now you're choosing a word and you want to realize that in the words you're choosing there's not one meaning. There are layers of meaning. That's leaving aside things like the gematria, the numeric meaning, the kabbalistic meaning, and the phonetic meaning, the sound of the words, and the shape of the letters. All these are all layers and layers and layers of meaning. So Arumim has two meanings, and Boshesh has two meanings. So he says, firstly he starts with the idea that you've got to understand that very often words with multiple meanings are used deliberately by the Torah because you're meant to interweave all these meanings together. And then he says the following. He says, Kol ha-nevi'im, mi shirotze lehitzdabek bashchina, with all the prophets of the Tanakh, anybody who wanted to cleave, to become intimate with God, because that's what prophecy is. Prophecy is becoming intimate with God, like one can become intimate with another human being. prophecy is Yahweh, so to say, becoming intimate with God. That's what it is. When a prophet wanted to do that, Nidrash lahafshit me'alav levushei haguf. He had to get naked first. That doesn't mean take off his clothes. It means actually take off his body. Because the body is clothing to the soul. So when we talk about image and identity, it's like these Kakeshi dolls, you know, these Russian dolls, one within the other, within the other, within the other. So the clothing is clothing, and the body lies under the clothing. But under the body there's a soul, and layers and layers and layers with that. So in order to get close to Hashem, you've actually got to get naked. It's interestingly the parallels. But it's not a matter of getting naked of clothes, it's a matter of getting naked of your physical drives, your physical characteristics. You've got to be able to actually, the term used in Kabbalah is hitpashtut hagashmiut, you've got to strip yourself of everything material so that you exist in a transcendent form where you've left behind anything material, and there are ways to do that. And then you can attach yourself to the Shekhinah, then you can attach yourself to Hashem. So this doesn't happen quickly. What I spoke about on Sunday night was the idea that Yaakov was upset that he didn't notice the sun setting early, so that he would know that there was going to be prophecy, so that he could prepare himself. Because you don't just transcend instantly. This is something you've got to prepare yourself. It takes some time. It can take hours of preparation to move yourself, to strip one layer of clothing and another layer of clothing and another layer of clothing until you've transcended from your body, from your physicality, to the degree that you can now attach yourself to Hashem. That can take hours. But man before the sin, haya arum, he was naturally naked. Doesn't mean without clothes. You see how we've now got to evolve our reading. When we were children, haya arum, he was naked, he didn't know, he wasn't a but we've got to grow up a little bit. It means that in one sense, but let's get into deeper meaning. And therefore, lifnechet haya arum mibli chatzitza mideot enoshi. There was nothing intervening. There was nothing of normal human characteristic and drives and nature intervening between himself and the ultimate spiritual interaction with Hashem himself. And that's the sense of that nakedness. So he could be intimate. So when he wanted to connect to Hashem, lo boshesh, what does that now mean?
Didn't delay.
There was no reason for delay. He could do it instantly. That was Adam. We haven't had anybody who could do that since Adam. Moshe came close, but we haven't had anybody who could do that since Adam. Attached to the Shekhinah instantly without hours of preparation. That was something Adam could do. So that's now it has a whole completely different meaning. So now when Targum Yonasan explains that Arum doesn't mean naked, it means Hakimim. He was super brilliant, super wise, super spiritual. Now we understand what that means. What's the connection between Chakimin and Arumin? The true wisdom is a wisdom that is divorced from your physical drives, from any subjective interaction. That's when you can get to real truth. So you need total transcendence from everything physical in order to understand the spiritual and have true wisdom. That's why we use the same word. Arum, meaning both wise, doesn't mean sly necessarily. It means the ultimate of wisdom. Yes, it can be used for slyness, because what happens if you have the ultimate of wisdom? Then you know how the world operates. If you know how the world operates and you know how people operate, you can manipulate. And that's, people like Bilam did that. You've got people who had spiritual wisdom who manipulated. Even today we've got people who manipulate with their spiritual wisdom. Doesn't mean they don't have wisdom. They can have wisdom and use it manipulatively. That's why one has to be very, very careful. And sometimes even with spiritual people, with Jewish spiritual people, with people who claim to be religious people, one has to be, the fact that they do miracles doesn't mean anything. It's irrelevant. Any spiritual person can do miracles. It doesn't mean they're tzaddikim. It doesn't mean they're righteous. That's why Arum means both things. Arum means the highest level of wisdom and spirituality, naked of all physical interaction. It also means sly and manipulative. Because you can do that. It depends how you use that. So that's how the Netziv introduces the idea. And one can then understand it. What then of the Nachash? Why does the Nachash get involved? Who is the snake then? And what is the snake? So Rashi said the snake saw them having being intimate with one another, and he got jealous. So now let's elevate that into an adult understanding. What does that then emerge? Then we've got to say. So we'll see. Before we even get there, so if Adam wasn't naked, so now we've taken on our adult understanding. They weren't naked. Well, I think Shem's gonna. It never made sense to me. To understand it in the childish way. Yeah, Ibn Ezra learns it that way. Ibn Ezra says it's all purely literal. Adam and Eve were naked. The snake could speak. The snake seduced Chava. Everything is literal as it says, is the Ibn Ezra. But he's the only one. Most don't take it that way. So if we now try and understand it with our adult sense, what was he then wearing? Then he wasn't really naked. That's nonsense then, if we see it from an adult perspective. Because Arum doesn't mean that. Arum means he was naked of his physicality. But later on, we're told, God made them clothes of leather. So what were they wearing at this stage? What were they actually wearing? Were they wearing anything? And if so, what was it? Always intrigued me. And I only today discovered a piece of Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer goes back many thousands of years, where Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer asks that question. And says they were made clothes later on. What were they wearing before? Now, he also doesn't say, what do you mean, what were they wearing before? They were naked before. He doesn't answer that. Which means the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, many, many centuries before the Netziv, millennia before the Netziv virtually, takes it for granted they were wearing something. There's no question they weren't naked. What were they wearing? Ma haya levusho shel Adam HaRishon. What was Adam wearing before the sin? And he answers, Or shel tziporim va'anan kavod mechuse alav. A radiant ivory coating of almost of scales. So like these prehistoric, some of these prehistoric beings. He was covered with scales that were radiant, and the radiance was shielded with the clouds of glory that later on shielded the children of Israel as they went through. The desert. So there was such Kedusha. He was so vibrantly spiritual and connected to Hashem. The levels of energy were so strong that he was radiating an energy that was covered with the clouds of glory. So that's what they were wearing. They had this ivory shield, this kind of scale. And that's the reason, by the way, that we're careful with nails. That's where that Kabbalistic thing comes from. But when you cut your nails, you make sure to dispose of them properly, because if a pregnant woman stands on a nail, it's not good energy. Why? What's a woman, pregnant woman, got to do with that? Because as a result of Chava's action, we lost that covering of scales, and all that was left are the fingertips. So we used to be covered with, like our nails, used to cover our whole body. And because of Chava, all that was left are the nails of our fingertips. And just to be conscious of the fact that that's where they come from, we're careful when we cut nails to dispose of them properly and not leave them lying around anywhere. So that's what the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says. And so now we're beginning to understand. So Adam and Chava were super on a super high level. They weren't these primitive, naive little people who had not at all. These were incredibly sophisticated people who had transcended entirely out of their physical beings and were clothed in this ivory covering with the clouds of glory around them, very powerful physical forces, spiritual forces. When they ate from the tree, they lost that. So we'll understand that, and we'll see when we get there exactly what happens. So now let's look at the Sforno and try and understand another way of approaching. If we're going to say, okay, so what then was the snake? If this was all not literal, if these people were incredibly great, and Arumim doesn't mean they were naked, and it's not about them having intimate relationships with one another, they were having intimate relationships with Hashem. So what does the snake see? What does the snake get jealous of? So here again, I'm going to learn this inside because it's so, I need you to understand that it's not me saying this. This is how the Sforno also from the 12th century, understands it. So of the Nachash, he says, "Hu Satan, hu Yetzer." This is not the snake talking. This is an image for the force of the Satan and the Yetzer. So we have to understand, what is the Satan? What is the Yetzer? This is the energy in the world that causes mischief, that causes things to go wrong. There's a force in the world, there's an energy in the world, a kind of an entropy in the world that causes us to go wrong, to go off track, and to do things we later regret. And he says, Ki omnam yikra davar b'shem ezid omelo, it's often the Torah will use a metaphor, k'moshe nikra hamelech arge, like you call a king a lion. Doesn't mean he's a lion, it's a metaphor for royalty. So here, Nachash is a metaphor for this Yetzer Hara, this evil energy in the world. And the Nachash is the metaphor. And what is it exactly? Now he describes it. Vahu, this is Shehakoach HaMitave HaMachti Yaseze BeEmtzaut HaKoach HaMedame. There are two forces within us that when those two forces couple, we get into trouble. The one is, and they're all image related. So this is now, that's why it's the Nachash, it's outside of Adam. Adam doesn't have all this, Adam and Chava, because they're now very pure, they're intimate with Hashem. But there's a force in the world which later gets incorporated into Adam and Chava. At this stage, it's not yet incorporated. And the force is the force of desire and imagination. Now, we talked about those forces last time, because we said without image, there's no imagination. And without image, there's no desire. You can't want something you don't have if you don't have imagination. And imagination is something outside of you. It's imagining something that you are not, or having something that you do not have. So imagination is external. Imagination is not internal. It happens inside. But you're imagining something external to you. You're imagining something beyond you, the idea of visioning, of seeing a future that isn't a reality now, but could become a reality. So being able to see what could be, that is the positive use of the koach hamedameh, of the power of vision, the power of imagination, to imagine something that isn't but could be. And the positive use of mitaveh is to want to grow, to want that vision, to want to accomplish that vision. So Hashem gives us these powers. Where they become destructive is when they link up and you start imagining things you want. And you always imagine them far more delicious than they are. That's what happens when imagination and desire come together. If it was just imagination, so you'd have a picture of something nice ahead of you. If it was just desire, so you would desire something, you haven't got it, so what? But with imagination, you can see it. And the more you see it, the more beautiful it is, the more desirable it is, the more you want it, until you get there. I'm just reading pieces at the moment in Proust, in the third volume of Proust, that deal so beautifully and magnificently with the evaporation of the reality that was in your mind when you imagined that which you desired. Whether it's a woman or whether it's a beautiful piece of art or whatever it is, as you get closer and the reality starts becoming real, all of a sudden you realize what was in your head was not the other person. It was your desire and imagination who had built a completely different person. And so it is with every human experience. When we desire and imagine together, that's the Yetzer Hara. Spurner defines the Yetzer Hara. So you've often heard the term, a Yetzer Hara. What's a Yetzer Hara? Yetzer Hara, if we want to get more adult and sophisticated, is when desire and imagination link together to create an image of something you want that is unrealistic. The image is realistic. It looks real and it feels real, but it's not real. And that's incredibly dangerous.
Because you're justifying it.
Because you go after it. You pursue it. You want it. You pursue it. You can see it. For you, it's real. And it's kind of insanity. And that's why the Gemara says, Ein Adam Chote Elohim Kein Nichnas Bo Ruach Shtut. A person only sins if he's gone a little insane. Because sinning, that's what sinning is. If you know the reality and you know the truth, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't sin. So what happens? You see something and it's incredibly beautiful and it's just what you want, and it gets better and better as you imagine it more and more, and then you start rationalizing it's not so bad. But that's insanity. To pursue something that you believe is real, but you know it isn't. Kind of. You believe it's real, but you know it isn't. and you pursue it, why would you do that? It's like running, it's like a mishugana, running after a mirage. Everybody else can see there's nothing there. He's running after it. That's mishugas, that's craziness. And that's the Yetzer Hara, and that's the metaphor of the snake. And then he says, what does it mean that the snake was arum? That the snake was sly? Ki ha-koach ha-dimyoni ha-movil tmunot ha-ta'anugim el ha-koach ha-mitaveh, because that's sly. For the power of imagination to deliver pictures to the power of desire, that's sly. Because desire on its own would be fine with desire. You've got desire. Nothing wrong with desire. Imagination on its own, fine. But for imagination to deliver pictures to desire, that's incredibly damaging. It's like with the internet. Part of the damage of the danger of the internet, just as Koach HaDimyoni is a wonderful tool, and Koach HaTava, a wonderful tool, desire, imagination, wonderful things, we need them, we use them, but when they get together in the wrong way, they lead us into incredible trouble. So the same with the internet. It can create a picture of things that appear real, and now we're getting into virtual reality and artificial intelligence and all those areas. It's this on steroids. That now you're getting a whole world of nonsense, of nothing, of something that isn't real but looks real and feels real. A friend of mine put on some virtual reality goggles or whatever they are and had an experience. He said, "You don't want to come out."
Wow.
He said it is so powerful. He said it makes drugs, because somebody has tried that too. It makes drugs look flat. You don't want to count. It's the most depressing thing to take those goggles off. That's what we're moving into. So it's a world, but in a sense, the world is like that as well. All that this is doing is, it's making it clear to us. So we can talk about it and say, oh, that's terrible. But we do it all the time. We do it in our imagination all the time. You imagine something, and you think that, as we talked last time about the glossy brochure, and you go to the beautiful holiday resort on the fantastic island. You get there, fantastic island. So, it's a marsh with banana trees and pineapples, and it's pretty flat, and it's humid, and it's. But you have a good time because you've already paid for it, you've already invested it. But it's not what you thought it would be necessarily. If what attracted you to it was the dimyon, or it was imagination and desire, rather than any kind of true understanding of what it is that you really want from a deeper perspective. So when we're attracted to the superficial stuff, we're not attracted to the essence. We're attracted to image, not identity. And then as you get closer, the image becomes less valid and less powerful, and you start seeing the identity, and identity is something very different. So that's the image that we're using here. And this power of imagination delivering pictures and images to the power of desire is chazak bahem yoter mima shehaya b'shaar ba'alei chayim. They have it much more powerfully than any other animal. So animals don't have that problem. A little bit there. A dog might smell some meat and go after it, but it's not the same, to the same level of being fooled by something that isn't real, that human beings are. So as great as we are, and he goes on to say, because ha-gadol mi-chabero yitzro gadol himenu, the greater the being, the greater is his power to be distracted by imagination. Because imagination is part of greatness. So the greater you are as a human being, the more your imagination functions and the more you have ambitions and desires. So these forces are, within their own rights, more and more powerful the greater a human being you are. And when they link together, when they come together, you have this enormous power of the Yetzer Hara. So that's who the snake is according to the Sforno. So now let's learn and try and understand it then. So what does it mean that the snake starts talking? Etc. Vayomer el ha'isha, and he says to the woman. So what is that about? So primitively, we say it's the snake. So different ways of understanding. So the Netziv, if we go back to the Netziv says that force. So what does it mean that the snake saw them, and they were being intimate, and the snake wanted chava, and the snake was jealous? What does that really mean? Says the Netziv, what it means is this force, this divine force, because this is a force of heaven, this is like an angel. So the angel force, angels are energy forces, that's all that angels are, and they can manifest in different forms. So an angel can manifest as an angel with flapping wings, I suppose. I don't know. And angels manifested to Avraham as three Arabs, travelers. So an angel can manifest as another human being. An angel can manifest as a sound. You hear something. An angel can manifest as a force that drives you. Sometimes you've had that experience where you're driven in a direction that you didn't actually choose, but it turns out to have been so right. That can be the force of an angel. Angels are these forces, are these energies in the world. So there's an energy of the Nachash, and we've now heard from the Sforno what kind of an energy it is, who sees. So this is like an angelic energy. Angelic in the Torah doesn't necessarily mean good. There are angels who are mischievous. There are angels who do bad things. Whatever Hashem tells them to do, that's what they do. So you need all sorts of forces. But these angels see the intimacy that man has with God and realizes angels can't have that intimacy. That's the jealousy. So these are the spiritual forces. This is not just the lowly snake. These are the spiritual forces. These are the higher parts of man. Now, if we bring the Sforno in and we say, the way the Netziv works, it's, I'm working on a number of different levels here. The way the Netziv works, it, there's this force that spoke through the snake. Yes, she heard the snake mouthing things and talking like Bilam's donkey talk. But it's not the snake talking, because snakes knew how to talk at that time. This was the only time a snake ever talked, according to the Netziv. The snake was mouthing sounds that were put into him by this divine force, and this had nothing to do with the zoological concept of a snake. Snakes don't talk. The Ibn Ezra says the snake, snakes used to talk until the curse. The others, well, no, the Netziv says, no ways. It doesn't say in the curse of the snake that God took his power of speech away. So clearly he never had a power of speech, because he was a snake, he wasn't a human being. So the way the Netziv learns it is there's this power, this force that God allows to speak through the mouth of the snake. The way the Sipona learns it, where is it all being spoken? In Chava's mind. In Chava's mind. This is a conversation going on inside her. Now, I'm sure there was a snake that was slithering around there, and this stimulated her. So to take it to this level, I want to take it to one level further of subtlety, not of depth necessarily, but of subtlety, and to understand how little we really hear. We think we hear what sounds there are, but there are sounds that we don't hear. So, for example, I was reading a few weeks ago about one of these massive telescopes that is in the desert somewhere in the United States, one of these huge, massive things. And they said, this thing, if there is any sound from any intelligent being anywhere in the universe, we will hear it. So you think there's this big thing there that is hearing things we can't hear. There are sounds from the universe, all sounds that we hear with our ears, we can't hear. But the sound is there, we're just not tuned in. You can have a radio with all its different channels. The sound is there. You just have to tune in. You can't be tuned into all the sounds. We hear a very, very tiny slice of the sounds that exist in the world. Now, when we hear sounds, it's interesting. I had a kind of an interesting mystical experience this last week, and I didn't know what it was for. But now I know. I know it was for the shiur tonight, but I wasn't sure at the time. I still said to my children, "This is so odd and weird, and what's it for?" But now I know what it's for. It was quite an interesting three. Now, when things happen three times, there's a reason for it. If thing happens once, it's a coincidence. If thing happens twice, it's already attracts interest. If thing happens three times, as Maharaj Shiva used to say, there's a common reason for all three, and you've got to find what the common reason is. Three is not coincidence anymore. We call three chazakah. So what was interesting was three different events completely. I only linked them after the third one. The first event was I watched a movie with my kids in Washington a week or two ago. And the movie we went to see was a new movie out called Arrival. Anybody seen it?
Yes.
Seen Arrival. So it's a brilliant movie about, it doesn't sound brilliant by the topic, but it is, of aliens that come to Earth, and a brilliant linguist cracks their code and figures out and saves the world from disaster by retranslating a word which she had mistranslated using English linear kind of thinking, and by thinking in a circular way, which is much more like Hebrew writing and thinking, by the way, she was able to to crack their code. So that was one. I wasn't even thinking it in terms of cracking codes, because that wasn't the language that was used. Then on Shabbos afternoon, I randomly pull a book off my shelf. Totally randomly. I haven't looked at this book for a long time. I wasn't driven to the book. I wasn't attracted to the book. I took it up randomly, and I opened it randomly, which I seldom do. Usually I open a book and I choose whether to start at the beginning, or I might look at the contents and start somewhere else. But in this case, I literally opened it and started reading. And the story was about Alan Turing and how he created the first computer during the Second World War to crack the Enigma code. That night, Motzei Shabbos, my daughter, Eitan's wife, says, let's watch a movie, let's see if there's something good on. And she says, there's The Imitation Game. I didn't know what The Imitation Game was. She gave me that. I said, yeah, it's the story of Alan Turing and cracking the Enigma code. So three events within a week about cracking codes. And what I understand is that that's what this piece of Kumash is about. Because we don't listen to what objects say. We only listen to what people say. We don't even listen to what animals say. Mm-hmm. And we know that Shlomo HaMelech could understand the language of the birds. It doesn't mean he could translate tweet means this and tweet tweet means that. That's not what it was. It means he could look at a bird and engage with the bird and understand intuitively what that bird was saying, doing, communicating. Now, that's something one can do with any source of energy. You can tune into a source of energy, and I gave you examples of that last time. You can tune into a source of energy, and you can access that. So if you can access, I told you the story of accessing the energy in a watch, in a phone, and how one does that. If you can access the energy in a physical object, you can certainly access the energy in any object, also in terms of, so what is it about it? So it's possible Chava is able to understand the snake like Shlomo could understand birds. So she understands what the snake is all about, and the snake is a metaphor. It's about cracking a code. And it's quite interesting. There's a beautiful moment in the movie, The Imitation Game, where as a young boy at school, his friend introduces him to cracking codes and shows him a book of keys and how you crack codes and how you make code, and that they used to communicate with each other at school by writing coded letters to each other. And he looks at the boy a little puzzled, and he said, cracking a code? He said, but is that any different to language? Aren't we always doing that? People never say what they mean. There's always a code. Now, we're used to just listening to somebody. If we know somebody very well, then we'll kind of understand. You say, how are you? They say, fine. And you know they're not really fine. So you kind of tune in. You say, no, I can see you're not fine. And I say, wow, how did you know? You're so intuitive. No, I'm just listening. Because you're not listening just to the meaning of the words. When we listen, you've got to listen to tonality. You've got to listen to energy. You've got to listen to context. There are all sorts of things. You've got to listen not just with your ears, but with your eyes. See body language. You're listening not just with your eyes. You're listening with your heart. You've got to feel. So when you're using all of these different kalim, all of these different tools to listen, you can access sounds and understand them that nobody's actually spoken out verbally. So she understands what the snake is, what the snake means. And she gets into this conversation. Now, was it with the snake or was it with her? Well, now it doesn't matter. She's getting into a real conversation with an energy that she personifies in the snake. But it's all going on inside her, and for the first time, this is gaining expression. Don't forget, they're new. This is her first day in the world, the first day of humanity in the world. This is all new to them. So she's just discovering this side of herself in this imagined interaction. But I don't want to say imagined in terms of made up, because when you are intuitively accessing what another person isn't saying, you follow what I mean? When you're truly hearing what another person isn't saying, that's not imagination. That's intuition. She wasn't imagining the snake speaking. She was intuiting a conversation of these different energies. The energy of the medameh, the energy of the mitaveh, the imagination and the desire and what happens when they come together. This whole picture is building up in her. And she looks at the snake slithering along and she says, that's that force. This is the energy of when these two things come together. And now this thing and she start getting into conversation. And the snake starts with, and I just want to show you how the snake, which again means her, because you'll understand the depths of the psychology of sin through this. You understand exactly how we do it. The snake says to her, is it true that Hashem told you you can't eat any trees in the entire garden? So what's he coming on as? Is he coming on as a reform rabbi or as an extremely orthodox rabbi? Extremely orthodox. He's not saying, did God say just, you know, the parable ones you can't eat, but you can eat the flesh, you can eat it. No. He says, I understand God forbade you to eat anything in the garden. And she answers, Mipri Eitz Hagan Lachem, not at all. God said we can enjoy the fruit of the tree. So what's going on in her mind? God didn't forbid all the fruit, so there's nothing inherently wrong with fruit. If there was something inherently wrong with fruit, he would have said no fruit. But he told us to enjoy the fruit, so fruit's okay. Mipri Eitz Hashem B'toch Hagan Amar Elokim, and about the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, Hashem said, this one don't eat from. Velotigubo, and don't touch it. Did Hashem say don't touch it? No. Who made that up? So the Avos de Rabbi Nassim says Adam. Adam told her, he was a very orthodox rabbi, Adam. So Adam says, God said don't eat it. That's not enough. Don't even touch it. So that was the first case, the Avos de Rabbi Nassim says, of a Gezeirah de Rabbanon, where the rabbis institute a gezeira, and they take it one step beyond the Torah's pure law. So the Torah says you can't write on Shabbat, and the rabbis say you can't handle a pen on Shabbat. It goes as far as that. The Torah says you can't have milk and meat together, proper beef and lamb and so on, and we say not even chicken. So that's not in the Torah, that's the rabbi's law. But these rabbi's laws are very important. We're going to see why. And then he starts, and there's the famous Medrash, we'll do more of it next time, where the Medrash where he pushes her against the tree and proves to her that nothing happens if you touch the tree. So that damages her confidence in the authenticity of the instruction in the first place. And there's just a piece of Vilna Gaon that I want to learn with you. We're learning all such interesting people tonight, so let's finish with a piece of Vilna Gaon on the psychology of sin. The Vilna Gaon says, Gilta lano haTorah kol ta'anot haYetzer hem ashnayim demishpichotam. The Torah teaches us that the Yetzer Hara, this force that misleads us, that gets us doing wrong things, by bringing together the imagination and desire, does so in just two ways. There are just two methods. If you understand these two methods, you can catch yourself and you can know what to do. Bitchila hu ba'al ha'adam b'ta'ana zu she'i efshar b'shum ofen la'adam l'kayim mitzvot Hashem yitbarach. First thing he starts with is, you know what, if you really are going to be fully God-fearing, it's actually not possible. Nobody can be perfect. So the first thing is shatter the idea that so it will take different forms. Or today it will be, in the olden days maybe, but today it's not practical. In the old days, there was a need for kashrut because things were... Today, there's not a need. In the old days, there was a need for Shabbat. Today, it is an argument that we put to ourselves to invalidate the wholeness of the Torah system and say, well, the integrity of the Torah system can't be maintained by a human being. You're going to be breaking it and compromising at certain points, so you've got to accept that. And therefore, he says, if God says, don't eat from any trees in the garden, then you can't survive. So you see, that's not what God meant, and that's not what it's all about. And then the second thing is, after Adam had added the gezeira, Adam had said, you can't even touch it. Omnam hadavar yadua ki hanachash hu yetzer hara. So he goes like the Sipporah, the nachash is the yetzer hara. V'al zeh hayu shoalim oto lama hu matsui ben hagederot. And there's a wonderful medrash in the Yerushalmi that says, they asked the snake, why do you find yourself around the fences? Why do you hang out around fences? And he answers, he said, was I the first one to break a fence? I wasn't the first one to break a fence. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. So the Vilna Gaon explains, Rotze lomar, lama ata mefate et ha'adam b'tchilat ha'pitui b'siag v'geder v'lo al guf ha'avera atzma. Why don't you attack the proper avera? Why do you start with the rabbinic laws? So that when people want to undermine orthodoxy, they undermine it by attacking the rabbinic laws. Mm-hmm. Nobody attacks the Torah laws, because you'll throw the chumash at them. And that's what the Torah says. That's what Hashem. But the rabbinic laws is where you start the attack. Ve'yishuv tshuva nitzcha. And then he says, "Did I broke down the wall, the fences of the world, these rabbinic laws?" Yes, I introduced the method of destruction of Jewish values by attacking the rabbinic laws. Because the reason the rabbis put the rabbinic laws there is because it's not possible to keep the Torah laws without the rabbinic laws. The Torah only tells us what is essential. But the Torah is not there about what's practical. The Torah says you've got to keep Shabbat. What does keeping Shabbat mean? And we're given the absolute essence of the things that if we don't observe, we're destroying the essence of the Jewish soul. The rabbis come along and say, but that's not practical. We're going to have to hold back from doing certain other things if we're really going to keep the thing as pure as we want to. So you might have here in the United States, you don't have fences and walls around the gardens quite to the same degree as you do in a place like South Africa. In a place like South Africa, you have big walls in the on the garden. Does your family have a wall outside there?
Definitely.
They have a big wall with a barbed wire thing on top, electric wire on top, the whole story. Now, the fact is, if somebody from the street wanted to cross the boundary, that's not what we would get upset about. What don't we want? Why is there a fence over there? Because we don't want them on our lawn? Not really. It wouldn't be the end of the world if somebody came and sat on the lawn for a few minutes or walked across the lawn. Not the end of the world. You don't want them in the house. But if you don't want them in the house, where do you put the wall? Not by the house. You put the wall beyond. That's the idea of a rabbinic law. You can't put the wall where the next step and you're in trouble. You want to put a fence around a swimming pool, you don't put it right at the swimming pool. You put a little bit away so that even if you get over the fence, you've still got a few moments to save yourself or to save a child from falling in. You don't do it that if somebody gets over the fence, they're right into the water. That's not how you build fences. That's the nature of a fence. A fence, by its definition, is a little bit away from the essential thing that you're trying to protect. And that's the rabbinic laws. And it's interesting with the rabbinic laws. The rabbinic laws are there also to protect protect normality. Because it's not normal. The amount of concentration you need to hold a pencil in your hand. Imagine you're sitting in a lecture, which you're allowed to do on Shabbat. Holding a pencil in your hand, which you would be allowed to do if it weren't for the rabbinic law. Holding a piece of paper in your hand, which you're allowed to do, but you can't write. That requires such constant awareness of what you can't do. The Torah doesn't want you involved in what you can't do. The Torah wants you involved in what you can do. So don't pick up the pencil so that you can focus on what you can do, not what you can't do. So all the rabbinic laws, if you go through to them, that's how they're constructed. So that you don't have to think about what you can't do. You can focus on what you can and should do. So the rabbinic laws are unbelievable gifts. But the first thing that anybody who wants to undermine orthodoxy will attack is the rabbinic laws. Who needs them? Where do they come? They're just human beings who made laws. What God says, I'll keep. But I don't have to keep what some other human being said. And that's the method of the Nachash. That's where the snake starts with Chava and starts to attack her intimacy with God, which is the one level we've been learning on, out of which will be damaged her intimacy with Adam. Because that intimacy works together. A person knows how to be intimate or doesn't know how to be. You can't be intimate with people but not with God. Intimate with God but not with people. Intimacy is a way of being, and it's a way of being vulnerable. It's a way of stripping yourself of image. And if you can do that, you can do that in many areas. And so the snake attacks Chava's ability to be intimate with God, and as a result of that, he's also attacking your ability to be intimate with Adam. And that's the piece that we'll study next week. Next week we can have a shiur, if you would like to. We can meet again next week, which is the 21st, is it? Yes, I think it's the 21st. If that will probably be the last one for the year. But next week, the 21st, we can meet. If you did not get an email for this shiur, then you're not on the email list, so if you could speak to Mr. Benji, and make sure that you're on the list so that when we need to cancel a share or change a share, that you get noticed and you get noticed in good time.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Sure, let's just take a few questions.
Last time when we were here,